This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Today on the show, 3 years and no divorce settlement yet. A look at Brexit. But first, we think we know winter here on the Great Plains. The people and animals some 1,500 miles north of us in the Arctic Circle might beg to differ. Mountaineer and polar explorer Lonnie Dupree grew up in Minnesota and became the first person to summit Denali alone in the winter. Outside Magazine called him the most badass adventurer of 2015. He spoke recently at TEDx Fargo.
Life in the middle of nowhere. When Neil Armstrong went to the moon, it wasn't about getting there first. It wasn't about beating the Russians. It was about seeing life from a different perspective. As a young boy of 8 years old when this happened, seeing the Earth from this perspective really shaped my life. It told me how fortunate, how special, what are the odds that we get to be on this little blue marble? What are the odds? And this little blue marble told me that it's a place we need to take care of. This whole vision of Earth as a little boy just really changed my life. And I too wanted to be an explorer like Neil, but I wanted to go explore cold places. Why the cold? I grew up in Minnesota. I grew up on a farm. Summers were hot and humid. It actually was quite stifling for a young boy. I always longed for winter. I didn't have to do any more farm work once winter came in. Once winter came, it was amazing. The lakes froze over. The snows came. By having the lakes and rivers freeze over, it expanded my horizons for exploring as a boy. And I went on to learn as much as I could about the cold. Being from Minnesota, I pretty much thought we were as far north as north goes. But lo and behold, north goes another 1,500 miles. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And then I went on to learn that there were Inuit people living up there. And I'm wondering, how do these people possibly stay warm? What do they eat? How do they dress? How do they travel? So I went on to learn everything I could about those folks over the years. And this led to basically 30 years of polar exploration for me. One of the expeditions that were probably the most dear to my heart was we did the very first ever circumnavigation of Greenland. Now, Greenland's 6,500 miles around. It took us 22 months in a tent to get around it. All non-motorized. We kayaked around the south, and we dog sledded around the north. And I just did this with one other friend of mine, John Holzer from Australia. Now, when people ask me to describe Greenland, I tell them it's where ice is born. It actually has most of the northern hemisphere icebergs come from Greenland. The whole Arctic Ocean dumps out 85% of its Arctic Ocean sea ice down the east coast of Greenland and up the west coast. So the whole periphery of that island has a blockade of ice around it about 5 miles wide. So it's one of the reasons it's never been circumnavigated. When we couldn't paddle our kayaks anymore, we would simply pull the kayaks up on an ice floe and we'd drag that boat across until we could find water to paddle again in. In the north, we traveled with sled dogs, and these aren't any old regular sled dogs. These are the Sherman tanks of the mushroom world. They live a feast and famine lifestyle with the polar Inuit for over 5,000 years. It's the same dog that Robert E. Perry used to discover the North Pole in 1909. So these dogs were going to be our companions for the entire north part. So we ran traditional Inuit fan hitch with our dogs, and they worked for us each day of the journey around the north, some 3,000 miles around the north part. And they were amazing source of entertainment every day we were on that trip. And they protected us against polar bears coming in for a visit. A lot of our expeditions seem insurmountable, like going on to the Arctic Ocean. The Arctic Ocean is 1.5 times bigger than the United States, plunges to a depth of 14,000 feet deep, And we got to pull 250-pound sleds for 600 miles from Canada to the North Pole. How are we going to do that? You get to the edge of this ocean and go, how many days am I going to be doing this? How many miles have we got to travel? But you don't think about that. You think about just one day at a time. Don't think about the miles or the number of days you're going to be gone. This is our job. We're going to get in tune with the environment and get moving and just do what we needed to do. So on this expedition, called the One World Expedition, it was to bring attention to climate change and the receding sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. And along that 600 miles, Eric Larson and I would be measuring ice thickness measurements for over 600 miles for the Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. Now, you got to think of the Arctic Ocean as a kind of a frozen body of water, like a big lake, right? A really big lake. Sometimes we get to these cracks in the ocean called leads where we either have to jump across or we have to use a little block of ice to move across. Sometimes we had to swim. And we would don dry suits. We'd have our ski outfit on, but we just fit in this big Gumby suit. And Eric and I would do the rock, paper, scissors to see who had to go in the water. And then one of us would do the backstroke across this thin ice, dragging the boats behind us with a rope tied to our foot. And then the other person would just ride on the boats. And then to just spice things up, we had polar bear encounters. We had 5 polar bear attacks on this expedition. I'll tell you about one of them. We're about 3 weeks onto the ice, and I got the sleeping bag pulled up tight against my face, and I'm just shutting my eyes, and I'm dreaming about eating a steak. And all of a sudden, I hear woof. And I open up my eyes, and the ceiling of the tent is pushed against my face. Eric and I both knew it was a polar bear on the tent. It's the only thing it could be. So the only thing we could do, two brave polar explorers, was scream. And as soon as we screamed, the tent popped back to its original dimensions. I looked out the door very cautiously, and the bear was just hightailing it across the ice cap. I think he was much more scared than we were. Needless to say, we didn't get any sleep for the next 2 days. With the age of modern-day polar exploration coming to an end, a lot of the geographical and exploration first had already been done. I moved my sights to a more personal journey, a solo winter ascent of Denali in January. Denali is North America's highest peak. It is 20,300 feet approximately, but it's a really gnarly mountain to do it in winter. It blows 60 miles an hour. Sometimes up to 100 miles an hour, minus 50 to minus 70 below zero on the summit. And I'm going to try to tackle this solo. How I'm going to do that, if you're traveling solo, of course, there's no ropes. So the only thing that will keep me attached to the mountain are the crampons on my feet and 2 ice axes. And just moving up very slowly, very methodically, very focused on my footing. At the end of 5 hours of climbing, because that's the only amount of usable light you have in the Arctic winter, I spent 1.5 to 2 hours building a snow shelter. So what I'll do is I'll dig 4 feet down, I'll put snow blocks over the top of it, and the incentive for building a snow shelter on Denali in the middle of winter is if you're too tired to build your snow shelter, you're going to be dead by morning. So sometimes I have to spend up to a week inside one of these rudimentary snow shelters waiting for a time to make my bid for the summit. And on January 2015, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I was the first to reach the summit of Denali in January. That was my 4th try, my 4th winter, after spending over 100 days over the course of 4 winters trying to get to the summit, but finally made it. But a lot of people ask me, how do you find the time or the resource to do these things? And of course, I got a few sponsors, but for me, it's about living really simply. I live in a small cabin, and I always think small things, small problems, big things, big problems. But during all my expeditions, the things that reminds me the most is just how small, fragile, and special our life is in the middle of nowhere. Thank you so much.
Yeah. That was polar explorer Lonnie Dupree speaking at TEDx Fargo. He wasn't the only one whose adventures are because of a deep love and concern for the Earth. David O'Hara travels the world to study climate health and how we interact with our world. And in his TEDx presentation, he examines this through the lens of bear poop.
Well, I'm a professor of environmental philosophy. And since most people that I say that to have no idea what I'm talking about, I'll tell you a little bit about what I do. One of the things that I study is the relationship between fish and forests. And that probably doesn't clear things up very much at all, does it? I spend a lot of time in libraries, of course, reading law, reading environmental science, trying to understand the biology of fish, the biology of forests. What's going on with fish and forests? I'm concerned with this, though, as an environmental philosopher, because I want to make sure that the way that we interact with the woods that we have and with the fish that we have is something that's sustainable for the long haul. And I'm going to start off with a little bit of a downer. We are fishing our way down the food chain around the world. But the good news is, I think it's not too late to change that. And what I do as an environmental philosophy professor is I want to teach my students how to care for every piece of the ecosystem in which the fish live. So in addition to going to the libraries and trying to find out what I can about the fish there, I spend a lot of time in places like Alaska, up in the Arctic, in Lake Clark National Park, and down in Guatemala and Belize. I teach in Spain and Morocco and in Greece as well, just to look at the way that we're using fish in different parts of the world. Now what you're looking at right here, this is a picture I took up in Alaska. This is a male sockeye salmon. You can tell he's male because of the hooked jaw. It's a sockeye salmon. You can tell the color, the bright red color. That's the color that it turns when it's spawning. So this is a fish that has spent the last few years of its life in the ocean, and it's come back up river in order to spawn. I was in my tent in a place where we get 23 and a half hours of sunlight in the summertime, trying to figure out when I can fall asleep, and thinking about this question, whose responsibility is this fish? Who owns these fish? Whose fish are these? Sometimes that feels like a very silly question, because I don't even know how you answer that question. But it becomes an even more strange question when you're lying in your tent, and about an arm's reach away from you, the grizzly bear starts to sniff at your tent, and you realize, oh, I'm here to study the ecosystem, and in so doing, I have become part of the ecosystem. So what I want to talk to you today is about bear poop and unnecessary knowledge. And hopefully none of us ever become either of those two. So here's a picture of some bear poop. I took this picture in Alaska, and I want you to have a look at it. I know you're probably thinking, Dave, I just had breakfast. I'm not really interested. But look at what you see there. Of course, there's the brown that kind of fills up most of it. That's the poop part. But do you see what else is in there? Seeds. Seeds and even some undigested berries. Think about this. There are plants out there that, if you will, know that they're going to be eaten by bears. And some of the berries don't get digested. And the bears become the way that those seeds move around from one place to another. And not only that, when the bear poops, the seeds are now in fertilizer. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? It's as though the plants and the bears knew that they were part of an ecosystem because the bears are later going to eat those berries. This is another picture of bear poop that I took up in Alaska. And here you don't see so many seeds. Probably the seeds have been picked away by birds, but you see what is in here. The little round things that you're looking at up there, those are vertebrae of salmon. And the long white things, those are the rib bones of salmon as well. So in the summertime, when summertime hits Alaska, the bears go out and they feast on salmon when the salmon come running back up the rivers, and they feast on berries. And these two things join together in the bears, and when the bear poops, you've got this salmon-flavored bear poop that's full of blueberries. It's pretty fantastic. So here's another one of those sockeye salmon. There's another little sad thing that I have to tell you about salmon, and that is that most salmon, when they spawn, they die, which means that their children are born as orphans. Most salmon are born as orphans. But the salmon nevertheless take care of their children. by continuing to be part of this ecosystem. So what you're looking at right here is fish and forests right next to one another. Now, all that's needed is for something to take that fish out of the water and bring it up onto the land. One way that happens, of course, is when the bear eats it and you saw the bear poop. This right here is the jawbone of one of those salmon. And do you see all the plants that are growing around it, that are growing in the body of that salmon? Now, think about this. This is a marvelous mystery. These fish, when they're a few centimeters long, when they weigh a few grams, they swim down the river into the ocean, and they live there for years, and they vanish from our sight. We don't do a very good job yet of tracking where those fish go, but we do know that when they come back, they might weigh 1,000 times or more what they weighed when they went out. Here's another interesting, marvelous mystery. When the rain falls on the mountains, and you can verify this by looking at a satellite map of a river mouth. Anywhere a river goes into the ocean, and you'll see it makes a fan shape. And that fan shape is all the alluvium, it's all the sediments, it's all the nutrients from that mountain that have washed down to the ocean. When these salmon swim back upstream, what they've done is they've gone down the river, and they've gathered up all those nutrients again in the form of all the things that they've eaten that have been fed on those nutrients, and they return them to the mountain. In a way, salmon are the way that mountains swim back home. I could talk to you for a long time about bear poop and about unnecessary knowledge. I want to focus on the unnecessary knowledge part. And I'm going to take you down to Guatemala just for a moment. I was with some rangers in the Petén Forest up in northeastern Guatemala 2 years ago. And we were drinking tea made from one of the trees that was hanging over us. And I saw some lizards running by. And you probably can't see it, but there's four lizards in this picture. You can see right at the top, there's one that's kind of blurry right there. There's three more that look just like it in the picture. And I could not get my camera to focus on them. And I snuck up slowly to the lizard so that it wouldn't get scared away. And I could not get the camera to focus on it. I wanted to get a picture of that lizard. Because when I'm in the wild, you see, I like to document what I'm seeing there, and then bring it home and I can show it to my students. So later on, when I got back home, I looked at this and zoomed in just a little bit closer and saw what my camera was looking at that I failed to notice. Do you see it at the bottom of the screen? Much bigger than the lizard, there was a frog sitting there closer to me than the lizard, looking right at me, and somehow I didn't see it. Here's the thing. You and I, when we have a task to do, we go out looking for the things that we think we need to know. When I go up to Alaska wanting to understand the fish and asking the question, who's responsible for these fish? I go to look for the fish, and then a bear shows up outside my tent and starts sniffing while I'm trying to sleep. When I go to Guatemala, I see something really cool like this lizard, and I really focus on it. I think that's the thing that I need to take a picture of. When you're training the people that you're supervising, when you're sending your children off to school, think about the ways that we do this. We say, well, what you need to do is learn these things, focus on that, do those things. And what I want to advocate for today is more than that. Don't just go to the library. Don't just focus on the trees and miss the fish or the other way around. But take some time to look at the bear poop in your life. Now, this is definitely not something very attractive. It's not something that you want to track home. You don't want to have this on your shoe when you return from a hiking trip. It's an absolute mess. But aren't there a whole lot of things in our lives that feel like that? They feel like a distraction. Maybe it's even people in your life who feel like a distraction. Maybe it's the weeds, the things that we've called weeds. Maybe it's simply the study of poetry. For some reason, every culture in the world has written poetry and preserved it for thousands of years. And for some reason, most of us don't read it because it doesn't feel like it's quite got the necessity, like it's worth our time. I'm going to leave you with one more image. It's not the same image, but it's something that it's a picture I took right next to this one. Imagine the bear comes by, it's eaten some salmon, it's eaten some berries, and then it deposits this that you see right here. Now let the sun and the rain work on it for just a little while. And this is what you get. What's the bear poop in your life? And how might it be a mound of fertility that's just waiting for you to pay attention to it? Thanks.
David O'Hara chairs the Department of Religion, Philosophy, and Classics at Augustana University in South Dakota. Coming up next on Main Street, Bullhead Fish.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. And by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. For the avid fan of fishing, not much beats a day on the water, reeling in catch after catch. You do need to know a lot about the fishing ecosystem if you want to be good at fishing. In this week's Natural North Dakota, Chuck Lura helps anyone on the hunt for bullheads.
It's about this time of year that schools of bullhead fry seem to be seen swimming around near shore areas of North Dakota lakes and streams. It might surprise you, but there are three species of bullheads native to our state, the black, yellow, and brown bullhead. It's the black bullhead that's the most common. Bullheads and catfish are occasionally confused. They're in the same fish family, but an easy way to tell them apart is that bullheads have squared tails while catfish have forked tails. And I think most people would agree that catfish are better eating. You may see catfish on the menu in some restaurants, but not bullhead. Bullheads are native to North America, basically east of the Rockies, where they prefer slow-moving streams and shallow lakes with soft, muddy bottoms. They're widely known to tolerate very warm water with very low oxygen levels. They can tolerate low oxygen levels in part by coming to the water surface to gulp air. They can also absorb some oxygen through their skin. As most anglers know, bullheads are bottom feeders that'll eat most anything. Their diet consists of a wide variety of plant and animals, ranging from algae and worms, mollusks, insects, dead fish, and crayfish. They have a well-developed sense of smell. So do catfish, thus the common use of smelly baits. They have thousands of taste buds scattered all over their bodies, particularly on their barbels. These sensors are thought to help find food in muddy water. Bullheads spawn in late spring and early summer, roughly April through June. Each female may lay between 2,000 and 6,000 eggs in a small depression she's excavated at the bottom of the body of water. The male then watches and cares for the eggs by fanning them to keep them oxygenated until they hatch. Once hatched, the females also join in parental care until the young grow old to 2 inches long. It's these young fish, or fry, that we may see in schools this time of year. Schooling serves to help protect fish from predators such as northerns and walleyes, as well as cormorants, herons, and pelicans. And of course, most people probably know that bullheads have sharp spines on their dorsal fins and pectoral fins. So if you ever have to handle them, be careful not to get jabbed. That's an experience not soon forgotten. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, a look at our What's Happening calendar of events and 3 years and counting for Brexit. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota is on par with the rest of the nation when it comes to seeing a slowdown in the regional economy. Creighton University economist Ernie Goss conducts a survey of supply managers in a 9-state Mid-America region, which includes North Dakota. Business Conditions Index shows the regional economy slipping from 55.4 at the start of June to 52 in July. Any reading over 50 indicates growth.
Our release was almost identical to the national number that came out. And that's also pointing to slower growth in the weeks and months ahead, but still positive.
Goss says the driving factor behind the slowdown is trade.
And it's a lot to do with manufacturers out there that are seeing less opportunities out there, more uncertainty with selling in China. But not just selling in China. We still have the USMCA, that's, of course, NAFTA, I'll call it NAFTA 2.0, is still in Congress. It's yet to be passed. It's yet to be signed by the president. That's very important.
Goss says there needs to be a change from the current hardline approach being taken toward trade. He says the policies are resulting in a lose-lose situation for America and its trade partners. The burden of rising prescription costs falls largely on older adults, and AARP North Dakota is calling on national leaders to find solutions. Here's Mary Schumann with that story.
AARP North Dakota members will be delivering nearly 3,000 petitions to Representative Kelly Armstrong on Friday that call for a crackdown on price gouging and unscrupulous practices that keep drug prices artificially high. Advocacy Director with the organization, Mike Shosey, says they hear from older adults all the time who have to make the difficult choice between purchasing their medicine or buying food.
And it sounds dramatic until you talk to people. And typically what happens is they forego getting the drug. And it's drugs that can help them live, but not only that, live healthy, productive, meaningful, wonderful lives.
Specifically, Shosey says reforms are needed that allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices, cap out-of-pocket costs for seniors, increase the availability of generic medication, and ensure pharmaceutical companies can justify major price hikes. Drug manufacturers say rising costs are the result of research and development, which they argue has created significant innovations. Mary Sherman reporting.
Starting today, drivers in Minnesota will no longer be able to hold their cell phones to make calls, text, or listen to music. The so-called hands-free law is designed to further reduce distraction while behind the wheel. Senator Jim Carlson is a member of the Senate Transportation Committee. He says there will undoubtedly be some who ignore the law, but penalties should drive many more to comply.
The $275 fine, plus I'm advised that there are ways that you can lose your license by getting so many tickets within a 12-month period. So I think that there will be an increase in compliance, just like we did with seatbelt laws.
In 12 of 15 states with hands-free laws, traffic fatalities have decreased by an average of 15%. Handheld phone use is allowed to obtain emergency assistance. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Divorces can be very difficult, and that's just between individuals and families. Now imagine one between countries. Great Britain voted to leave the European Union in 2016, and the three-year search for a deal has been unsuccessful. Newly minted Prime Minister Boris Johnson says it's goodbye by October 31st, no matter what. Augustana University professors Bill Swart and Jason Harris took students to watch history unfold earlier this year as part of the class Brexit, the Great Divorce, and life after the European Union. They visited with Lori Walsh of South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment.
Welcome back. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. Tell us who this Boris Johnson guy is, because we've heard his name before. He's integral to this entire conversation about Brexit.
Yeah, Boris Johnson is a bit of a cult of personality. He was a journalist most of his career, got in some trouble for misquoting or attributing quotes to people that were not true, and had lost his position in a couple of different newspapers, and then started running for politics with the Conservative Party. While he was a journalist, he was a staunch opponent of the European Union and Britain's membership in it, and has continued that in his political career. So it's, his position is not surprising at all, given his history.
Yeah, and he had written a biography on Winston Churchill and says that Winston is his mentor and has been trying to emulate him from the beginning. He was in the running for prime minister when David Cameron stepped down and Theresa May ultimately won that.
Right.
Arguably, people thought he was too extreme at the time. And now Theresa May muddled through 3 years and Boris doesn't seem so bad, I guess, now.
He is no longer too extreme. What's the appeal of this idea of, is this going to happen October 31st, no matter what? Before we talk about the ramifications, why is that an appealing sort of, you know, promise?
Your introduction talked about this going on for 3 years, and they've kicked the can down the road on several occasions, extended timelines and things like that. I think that there is an extreme amount of uncertainty among the British population. And that uncertainty is appearing in all sorts of different things, economically included. There's also this sort of level of sort of popular fatigue. People are just sick of it. And I was listening to a podcast this morning, and someone was recalling Easter, this past Easter, when Brexit got put on sort of pause and everyone took a deep breath, and it was like they had something to talk about other than Brexit. Now they're right back into it. So I think there's a sort of popular fatigue as well. And so this desire to get it done and get it done quickly and move on, I think that's part of where the appeal comes from.
But what, 70% of folks now say they'd vote against it, right? I mean, that's what the polls show. Is that relevant? Is that just a political talking point? where somebody who's against it says, look, 70% of us today would vote against it, so slow down.
Well, I think the demographics have changed since the vote as well. I think what you find in the Brexit vote, that there was a large divide between the young and the old, with the older tending to vote to leave the EU and the younger tending to vote to stay in the EU. And I think when we were there in January, somebody estimated that of the people that voted for Brexit, probably about 1 million of them have died since the election. And also an equal number of young people have become eligible to vote. So They do think there is some shift. I do think they are finally seeing that the economy is being hurt over in the UK, and it's being attributed to Brexit.
All right. So what's wrong with a hard break? What's wrong with a no deal Brexit? It's a nice, people can understand it. They voted for it. Get it done. What are the problems, challenges?
Boris Johnson says there aren't any. He says that we're going to, I read an article today, said going to make Britain great again. And he thinks that this will give them flexibility to do the trade deals, to not be regulated by a distant parliament that they don't have control over, and that, yes, there will be some short-term pain, but I think the year he used was by 2050, we will be on top of the world again.
2050.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Mm-hmm. Why not the no deal, Bill? I mean,
why not?
Who gets hurt?
I think vast proportions of the population get hurt by a no deal Brexit. I think that the interim in between negotiating, you know, what it's going to take to negotiate new trade deals can't happen until Brexit happens. And the interim in between, I think the country's own budget office is predicting, you know, significant financial and economic damages, including the possibility of a global recession. And I don't think that's out of the question. I think the consequences for Britain are dramatic. I think that the consequences for Ireland and Northern Ireland, we talked about this last time we were on the show, are dramatic, particularly because with a hard Brexit, the backstop goes away. And the backstop was put in place as a protection to not allow a hard border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. That's off the table. And I think that you could see the possible resurgence of violence in Northern Ireland. And I think it's bad for the world. I just think this is we're on the cusp of another 2008. And I think that the economic repercussions globally could be significant.
You said the phrase "make Britain great again," and so then I'm wondering, with the sense of President Trump, and obviously that's a play on his catchphrase, and this idea of we're going to do these trade deals one country to another, that's not working out so well for the American economy right now. What about Boris Johnson would make that still appealing? That it would be, you know, that we have these. You know, we're going to deal with each individual trade person, you know, country to country.
Well, I think the sense is more of control than it is whether it's going to be a better deal. I think what the UK and Britain is looking for is they want to control the trade deal and not have Brussels do it. I think we see similar things here in the Midwest, where sometimes we get frustrated with what's going on in Washington, D.C., and we would rather try to solve the problems ourselves. That's what I think much of this comes from, is that the UK thinks, number one, we can control the trade. We have the people. We have the manpower. We will get a better deal with the United States, they believe, than the EU is currently getting. And they can negotiate with the other countries as well. So I don't know if they're going to get the better trade deals or not. I do know that in negotiation there are various postures that you have to take. And so it could be that they take a hard line in order to gain more. I believe that's probably the position that they're coming from.
Is this idea of an October 31st, you know, take it or leave it, is that posturing? Is that just a way to go into the negotiations for Prime Minister Johnson with a different gravitas than Theresa May brought?
Well, and he's actually saying, you know, even earlier if possible. And you have to put that in, right, maybe September 31st. Which I think is interesting, because if you look at the parliamentary calendar, Parliament went on recess. They're not back until early September. And then they have like 2 weeks of conferencing. So if you actually look at the number of parliamentary meeting dates. There are only 9 of them before the end of October. So that means that what he's saying is we can get this done in 9 days, with 9 days of parliamentary debate, which I think is or less.
Unrealistic.
I think it's unrealistic. Yeah. And I think, you know, to Jason's point too, I think the other thing that's important to this is that, you know, with regard to, you know, negotiating trade agreements, Britain really hasn't been involved in negotiating trade agreements for the past 30 years. They don't have the staffing in place, or they haven't had the staffing in place to do that. And so that's all got to get ramped up and put in place by the end of October. Well, that's, you know, so that then that process of negotiating new trade agreements can begin at the end of October. And that's a pretty tall order.
What happens to Theresa May now? Is she done? Is she out of the picture? Was she still a voice in this?
Well, she remains to be a member of Parliament, okay, right. And so yeah, she's still there. I suspect that she will just kind of go to the background, and who knows what her reaction is going to be. I assume there's a sense of relief that she has, that this is no longer the problem that she has to solve. But she still remains to be a player and still remains to have a vote in Parliament. Yeah.
So this idea that it took 3 years and no deal was made, no deal's going to be made in 9 days then. So pretty much he's saying we're going without a deal, realistically.
I think that's a realistic assumption.
Or is there some scenario where all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, we've changed our mind? I don't know. You've looked at this pretty carefully. Is there another scenario where all of a sudden a more favorable deal, is what I'm asking, will appear on the table because it's Prime Minister Boris Johnson?
I think that's highly unlikely.
Okay.
And I think the problem is Boris, if you listen to what he says, if you read the articles on what he's saying, Boris is saying we can get this done, and he provides no specifics.
Right.
And the problem is this is incredibly complex. Even the deal that Theresa May put up to vote 3 times said we're going to leave the EU, but we're still going to have a 2-year transition period. And part of it is because you still have to have border controls. What are we going to do about border controls? What are we going to do about the 3 million people that are EU citizens that are living in the UK? And likewise, UK citizens that are living in the European Union, what rights do they have? Right now, they're all part of one legal entity. And if the UK backs out, now all of a sudden you're a French citizen living in the UK. What does that even mean? And Boris Johnson said today, don't worry, we'll take care of you. Well, what does that mean? Does your pension carry? Does your health insurance come with it? Will you still be able to work? Theresa May, I think, had a program set up where they, you know, could sign up for and get exempted from all of this. And when we were over there, it was you could do it, but it cost you £65.
You had to have an iPhone.
You had to have an iPhone, and
it wouldn't accept hyphens. So anybody with a hyphenated name had to do the paper, had to actually file then an affidavit on paper,
and then they still might get rejected,
right?
And so dealing with these problems, the UK government, basically in 99 days, if there's going to be a hard Brexit, has to have all of these systems in place: border control, trade control, free. You know, you've got the free movement of people, of goods, of services, and they don't have anything in place right now to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, the European Union's been rehearsing Brexit scenarios for the past year and a half. So they've been like working with the ports in Calais to try to put in place, you know, what's going to happen with new customs control there. They've been creating all sorts of, you know, working through all sorts of different scenarios to put political, economic systems in place in order to, in anticipation of a hard Brexit. Britain's done very, very little in preparation, and to think that this is all going to, you know, be able to be done in the next, you know, 2 months is again rather unrealistic.
Hmm. What else is sticking with you, and what else can you kind of, you know, turning over in your mind saying, what about this?
Well, there is a new EU president.
Okay.
Jean-Claude Juncker has been replaced by Ursula von der Leyen, and she has yet to. She's president-elect, And so she's been, at least from what I've read, relatively tight-lipped. She's been very congratulatory to Boris Johnson, but hasn't really said, hey, by the way, you know, we're not, you know, we're not reopening the deal. Michael Barnier, who was the primary lead, who was the lead negotiator for the European Union, has come out and said, look, you know, you got what you got. And we've already said multiple times, we're not reopening this. This is the best deal the EU will give you. So they're not, there's the potential that something could happen there, but I don't know. But again, I think it's rather unlikely given Barnier's comments.
What do you think is going to happen?
I knew you were going to ask that.
That's an unfair question. So you don't really have to answer it, but
I would put money on a hard Brexit.
Oh, you had to say that. I think
I would.
I mean,
yeah, okay.
We're not calling the Super Bowl, but
I'd put more on a hard than I would a soft.
Yeah, I think it's likely that that's the direction, that that's the inevitability at this point, because not only of the rhetoric, but because no other solution has been put forward.
I think that's the direction that they're heading. I think I think there's some other possibilities, but I don't see them working towards any other direction. The EU has said we're not going to negotiate. Boris Johnson and the hardline Brexiters have said we're not going to change our position, and has consistently said we're going to be out by October 31st. And so if he's not out by if they're not out by October 31st, then I think his whole premiership could, in theory, be in the balance. I mean, it already is, but it really could by then.
I'm going to put my money on, and we'll have this conversation after we're off the air. I'm going to put my money on kicking the can down the road.
Yeah,
I think that there's enough momentum behind the idea that the negative consequences of a hard Brexit are just too much to take. And the EU has come forward and said, well, if there's good reason to, we'll extend the deadline out again. I think it's going to get to a point where they're going to renegotiate, and they're going to come up with some way of getting the EU to extend that deadline.
What do you anticipate the relationship between President Trump and Boris Johnson to be? Is it going to be – is there potential there for those two leaders to make a connection?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, they already have.
They already have. I mean, you know, we just – the UK ambassador to the United States just left office. And there's some evidence – and this isn't – not to get too conspiratorial. I don't think it's very conspiratorial. There's some evidence to suggest that that was all orchestrated by the Leave politicians in Britain, that this was a headhunt that happened and he got ousted. But I think that in the end, any negotiation between the United States and the UK in terms of trade deals, the United States is going to win.
Well, Trump has already called Boris Johnson the British Trump.
Right.
And so, you know, as long as Boris cooperates with Trump, I think it'll be fine. But I do see them building a relationship. I see some similarities between the two, mm-hmm. in how they have come to power and how they plan on negotiating. It'll be interesting to watch.
Do you have plans to go back? Does it affect people who are Americans who are traveling? Does that change?
We're going back in January with another group of students.
Yeah.
So we're committed. I think that I wouldn't advise anybody not to travel to the UK at this point.
Sure. In fact, I would largely encourage it, because throughout all of this, the pound versus the dollar has – I mean, the pound this morning was somewhere around $1.24, $1.25. Prior to Brexit, it was in the $1.60 range. Mm-hmm. And so right now, the UK is incredibly affordable. If you can pay the $1,500 to get over there by plane.
Right.
That was Augustana University professors Bill Swartz and Jason Harris visiting with Lori Walsh of South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment. Coming up next, what's happening?
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Hey, Well, that is a question we ask once a week here on Prairie Public. What is going on? It's time for our What's Happening calendar of events. And joining me in studio is Christine McClellan. Christine, thanks for joining
us.
Hello,
of course. I'm here to say what's happening.
You do a lot of Prairie Public events, yeah. So we thought we'd have you take a look at what's going on in the rest of the state.
Of course.
So what you got?
All right. So first off, we have Aber Day's celebration and Sunday history programs. This is at Fort Abercrombie State Historic Site in Abercrombie, North Dakota. So this is going to be this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, August 3rd and 4th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. both days. So they have demonstrations of blacksmithing, tinsmithing, Civil War sewing, tin plate photography, and there will be some award-winning historical authors there who will be available for book signing and sales. So it'll be a fun historical time.
Rock the Lake 2019 is this Saturday, the 3rd, August 3rd. Can you believe it's already August today? This is in Minnewaukan, and this is action-packed days with proceeds benefiting the Minnewaukan Rural Fire Department. So the events here, a fishing tournament. Of course, it's on a lake. There's going to be a beanbag tournament, a vendor show, a bounce house, kids' games, parades, and a street dance with live music. You do have to register for the tournaments, but everything else is free. Rock the Lake 2019 this Saturday gets going at 8 a.m. I assume that's the fishing and not the street dancing. It goes all the way to midnight.
Dave Kofell is playing a show at the Spirit Room in Fargo on Tuesday, August 6th. Starts at 7 p.m. He plays broad-spectrum American progressive folk, country, rock, blues, and originals, as well as known covers on 6 and 12-string guitars and banjo. So $10 for a ticket, and again, that's at the Spirit Room on Tuesday.
In beautiful Sydney, Montana, the Richland County Fair and Rodeo has already started and runs through Saturday. So this got started as a small community street fair and then just grew and grew and grew into the county fair and rodeo, entertaining more than 30,000 people a year. Tickets to the rodeo start at just $5. The Richland County Fair and Rodeo today through the 3rd in Sydney, Montana.
There's a car show in Bottineau. This is going to be Saturday, August 3rd. Starts at 8 a.m., goes until 4 p.m. on Main Street in Bottineau, North Dakota. So come out and celebrate all things automotive. There will be classic cars, tractors, motorcycles, and snowmobiles from all across the state. And, of course, they'll have some great food, refreshments, some music entertainment, and some crazy day sales. And if you are a proud owner of a car, tractor, motorcycle, snowmobile, boat, etc., you are more than welcome to bring it. And, of course, it's free to attend and just enjoy everything on Main Street in Bottineau.
Capital A Fair this weekend on the Capitol grounds in Bismarck. This is one of the area's largest summer arts fairs. This is, again, at the Capitol Mall in Bismarck. Features more than 130 artisans from across the country, and it's free to attend. It gets going Saturday and Sunday at 10 a.m. Saturday goes till 6, and Sunday goes till 4. Christine, what's your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is the German Folk Festival. This is an annual folk festival that they have at Roll Farm here in Fargo. So this is going to be Saturday, August 3rd. Starts at noon and goes until 5. You can see examples of traditional German crafts such as lace making, wood carving, paper ornament making. There will be a blacksmith there doing demonstrations. And the best part is the German food. They're going to have Kuchen. And there's also a beer garden with traditional German beer. And if you bring your kids, they have some German crafts for them to do as well. And that's free. Again, that's at Roll Farm on Saturday.
All right. My pick is the Fiber Arts Festival this Saturday and Sunday at the Red River Valley Fairgrounds in West Fargo. So this is an event of people who are passionate about fiber making. I'm talking making their own material that they are getting from animals. And I mean, this is such a deep love for all things fiber related. So the Fiber Arts Festival this Saturday and Sunday at the Red River Fairgrounds in West Fargo. Free admission, free parking. That's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 1st. North Dakota was the land of Bonanza Farms. They were first established in the Red River Valley after John Wesley Powell's study of the Great Plains in the 1870s. He felt that a larger scale of irrigation would result in more land coming under cultivation. In his opinion, the family-owned farms of the Homestead Act were unable to cultivate the land in the way needed to get the most out of it. Soon after his analysis, the bonanza farms began to spring up. The term bonanza was a Spanish term that meant good weather. It was also used to indicate a source of great and sudden wealth. Bonanza farms were powered by the financial backing of large investors and new technologies like reapers, steel plows, and steam tractors. The flat land of North Dakota seemed ideal for powered farm equipment. Many bonanza farms did indeed produce great wealth for backers. These farms grew to encompass thousands of acres. In 1874, General George Cass and Benjamin Cheney, both officials with the Northern Pacific Railroad, purchased 13,440 acres west of Fargo. James J. Hill's farm in Minnesota sprawled over 45,000 acres. But not all of the big farms fared well. The financial panic of 1873 and the droughts of the 1880s hit farms hard. On this date in 1912, the Ward County Independent suggested that bigger was not necessarily better. The paper said that smaller and better tilled farms should be the slogan of the Northwest in the years to come. According to the paper, there was absolutely no reason why every farmer couldn't raise the best crop ever in 1912. The paper argued that many fields were in poor condition because farmers had tried to do too much. Small family farmers felt it was necessary to keep up with the big bonanza farms. They planted fields that should have been left fallow. They sometimes rented neighbors' fields that were not under cultivation. As a result, the newspaper noted that many fields of flax were overgrown with weeds. This was not because the farmer was lazy. He simply couldn't handle the extra work. He was out the cost of the seed and the work it took to plant it. Today, North Dakota farms average about 1,600 acres. The state is the country's leading producer of many products, including edible beans, durum wheat, and canola. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, a farm in Tennessee is a training ground for tomorrow's activists.
Now we're going to make a poster board about saying how we can have equal rights.
And in the 1960s, a black R&B star shines a light on civil rights through music.
We felt that would uplift not only our people, but all people.
The news and stories that inspire you on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the Reverend Brian Knutson of Minot has come out with a children's book that is an exploration of faith. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.